I think people have a perspective problem in terms of what a music career is. If everyone is trying to take the same path and everyone says, you know, success is playing Carnegie Hall or is being a classical recording artist, or for jazz musicians is playing XYZ festivals and playing with XYZ people. If you define success like this, which is the case for a lot of musicians, then you might confront failure a lot and early on.
That's Marc-André Séguin from jazzguitarlessons.net. After earning degrees in both classical music and jazz studies, Marc sought opportunities to play music across both large venues and jazz clubs in Ottawa, Canada, and beyond. But as many musicians know, sometimes you need to find other ways to supplement your income. And that's exactly what Marc did. After his first ebook sold only 2 copies, he regrouped and shifted his focus toward online courses and eventually a thriving membership community of excited jazz guitar students. A man of many talents, Marc not only has a passion for music, but also a head for business. In this episode, he'll share how he combined his passion with his business savvy to continue earning steady income and helping more students stop wishing and start playing. All this and more in today's episode of Everything is Teachable.
Welcome to Everything is Teachable, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes to learn how everyday creators have transformed their skills and passions into online courses and businesses. To introduce this week's episode, here's your host, Melissa Guller.
Hey everyone, I'm Melissa from Team Teachable, and today I'm here with Marc-André Séguin. Marc from jazzguitarlessons.net is the mastermind behind the #1 online resource for learning how to play jazz guitar. He draws from his experience both as a professional jazz guitarist and teacher to help thousands of people from all around the world learn the craft of jazz guitar. So Marc, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thrilled to have you. I'm so excited to learn more about your own jazz guitar experience and how that's transformed into what it looks like today. So let's go all the way back to the beginning.
Great.
How did you learn how to play jazz guitar?
Well, actually, as many musicians in their teenage, I was a, you know, angry teenager, and I would play mostly rock and roll, and I was very curious about music in general. And for people in, at least in America, looking to learn music academically, I would say, so going through college or university, you really had 2 paths, and one was classical and one was jazz. And of course, the jazz one is closer to the pop and rock music and stuff that's of this era, while the classical is something that's more, I would say, ancient. So I went for the jazz thing, and I didn't really expect to become a jazz player per se. I wanted to use, as my teacher said, you use jazz as a school. It's a learning tool, and then you play whatever you want for your music. So that's really how I got into jazz, and then I fell in love with it, and it became my #1 passion. So that's really how it happened.
That's funny how you didn't expect to continue pursuing that path. I'm sure that happens to a lot of people.
Lots of musicians I met. So a lot of people will be coming into school and be funk players, and they would become, you know, jazz players, or vice versa, just going into school and saying, yeah, you know, jazz is not for me at all. So that's also very common. Probably more common.
And what makes you say, for people who are maybe newer to jazz or who are not musicians, why do so many people learn jazz first before maybe thinking they might branch into other styles?
I guess it would be probably the opposite, because jazz is often deemed as the chess, quote unquote, of music, or it's like the mathematics of music. It's everything is more demanding, especially in the modern sense where you need to be improvising at all times. So it's often a very school-friendly approach to music, because you can really pinpoint what's right, quote-unquote, right and wrong about the music. So it's easier to grade and have, you know, courses around it and teach the tradition of it. So basically, I found that people go from being decent players and get into jazz later if they want to make a study out of it, or if they're in love with Frank Sinatra, either way.
That makes sense. Yeah, it's interesting. I think people who maybe have not had the pleasure of learning an instrument don't realize just how fundamentally different classical and jazz are. Like, I grew up playing classical piano, And it's so different because it's very structured. You read what's on the page. There are very, you know, regulated ways that things should go depending on the era the music is from. But with jazz, the whole basis of like the improvisation and even the chord types are different. It's just a totally different experience.
Oh, yeah. And it's more technical. And
much more technical.
It's demanding, as you said. So I know we're like getting in the weeds now of talking about jazz versus other styles. But actually, my wife is a classical pianist and also a teacher. Mm-hmm. We do pretty much the same thing, but for different instruments. And it's that whole, there is one sound that you should strive for, right? As a first violin in an orchestra, there's the sound. While in jazz, you're encouraged to develop your own sound, your own personality. So that was the appeal for me as well, just to express myself more so than become a machine to execute music. Right?
I love that explanation of the difference between finding your sound versus playing a sound. Mm-hmm. I'll ponder my own upbringing as a classical machine later on, but we won't let people listen to us talk about too much of our own music nerdy stuff. Mm-hmm. So you learned jazz guitar. How did you then grow your own career as a musician?
I was in Montreal for years. Now I'm back in my hometown, which is closer to Ottawa, but on the Quebec side. So in Montreal, it's a very effervescent, if it's a word, like it's boiling. There's a lot of arts, culture, rent is cheap, beer is cheap, food is cheap. So I stayed there and I developed a network of musicians. I would go, you know, out to hear gigs and out to jam session. And I developed my own sound and style and started to play, you know, this odd cocktail gig and then my own music. And then, you know, I get a little bit of a teaching gig in a small music school and so on and so on. So I learned the ropes through literally the traditional way of doing it. Just you show up and you play whenever you can and you try not to starve.
I feel like many people believe that it's nearly impossible to make money as a musician. So did you find that to be the case?
It's partially through... French-Canadian coming back. Mm-hmm. Partially true, yes. But I think people have a perspective problem in terms of what a music career is. If everyone is trying to take the same path and everyone says, you know, success is playing Carnegie Hall or is being a classical recording artist or for jazz musicians is playing XYZ festivals and playing with XYZ people. If you define success like this, which is the case for a lot of musicians, then you might confront failure a lot and early on. So yes, it is very difficult to make a living if you define success in that sense. However, when people start to get creative and go, well, I could not only teach, but I could develop products as I've done, you know, a product and a subscription business, and I could also branch off into things that are non-jazz, and I would be ready to say, make my own music, my own compositions, but not expect this to be my main way of putting bread on the table, you know, because, you know, I if we're jazz players, we're not Michael Jackson or, you know, Justin Timberlake. So it's difficult to make a living if you expect to make a living in a certain way. It would be like a writer saying, I only want to write for movies and I refuse to write for sitcoms or I refuse to write books or write blogs, whatever. It's like, well, you're a writer, you could write anything. So I think musicians, the purists, and I was not one, of course, they miss a lot of opportunities that are present in the world.
I think that's a great point. And I can't wait to talk more about how your own career and business has evolved. But especially in music, I feel like there could be a lot of pressure because the most famous, maybe some could argue successful musicians are celebrities. You see them performing on huge stages for tens of thousands of people or in these hallowed halls like Carnegie Hall. I mean, that doesn't have to be your definition of success. And to your point, as long as you're finding a way to earn a living and to support you or your family, maybe it is unrealistic to assume that you could be, you know, the A-lister. But that doesn't mean you can't be happy and enjoy a living playing money.
Exactly.
Playing music, playing money.
Oh, well, you could also play money for sure.
But, it would look a little bit different.
Yeah, but that's also a big thing. I watched Seinfeld, you know, the comedians in cars getting coffee. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he said is like, well, if you're here, you know, it's almost as if you want to be Justin Timberlake, like go for it, you should. But if you're asking yourself the question, then clearly you should not, because it's not something you need to ask and ponder, and you're twisted about your career choices. Like, if it's bound to happen, you will be that star. But if you're hesitant of making all those sacrifices, then that's where, like, well, maybe there's this other avenue or multiple different avenues to make a living making music. And as soon as you can accept that, or if you have someone older than you that's been through that, show you a way, then it becomes much more healthy. And people are less bound to experience failures, quote unquote, in the ways that really hurt them.
That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. It's almost like you can ask yourself, do you want to be a musician? Do you want to earn money? That's one thing. But then do you want to be a celebrity and have the lifestyle? That's a whole other ballgame.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like anyways, a lot of the things happen by accident in my life. And it's like, if you have to force it so much, probably not a good thing.
Mm-hmm. I found that when people, you know, work hard and put your heart into what's the opportunity that is right in front of you, good things tend to follow.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed on that, yeah.
So, perfect transition. Let's talk more about your evolution into the online world. So, I know you just mentioned you were earning money as a musician, but also teaching a little bit. So, how did you first get that idea to create your website, jazzguitarlessons.net?
So, that first inspiration, it's been developed in two phases. So, number one, when I got a degree, my second degree in music, actually, I got a classical degree and then I got a jazz degree. And when I got the jazz degree, I was living in Montreal. I was asking myself, other than teaching these private lessons to kids in private schools and playing the odd gig, how else can I pay my rent? And I developed this ebook, which was basically everything I knew condensed into 60 pages. So it was more of a book that I would have needed at the time, or I would have needed 5 years prior, right? I wrote almost to me. I wrote at a very high level of, you know, a college graduate trained musician that reads music and whatnot. So I wrote that and I built a one-page website and I tried to sell it. And it was, I think I sold two or three.
And a huge success.
A huge success. I put a lot of effort in the AdWords side. So I spent money. So I came out of this in the red. I came out broke. And it was the first experiment. And of course, I'm not patient, but I persevere a lot in life. So I was not happy with that. So a few months later, I came across something that you guys might want to look at it now. It's very archaic, probably, if they're still around. It's called SBI, Site Build It. And their promise was, well, instead of starting with a product, just build a website and pre-sell to the people. Just write good resources and content. And once you have the traffic, then feel free to monetize it, either with ads or with, you know, selling other people's product affiliates, or even building your own products from knowing that crowd that came to your website. So I jumped onto SBI on actually January 1st, 2009. And I registered jazzguitarlessons.net on that day. Actually, it was New Year's Day, and I started to work on there. So that's how I got in the online world. I had no really prior experience. Of course, I built websites as a kid. You know, you do this in high school. They show you HTML, but I had never gone beyond that, actually. So.
So once you bought the domain, what did you do first? What did the very earliest website look like?
Actually, you guys, I don't know if you know the Wayback Machine.
That's, oh, yeah.
That you do? Okay.
But will you explain it for listeners who haven't heard of it before?
Yeah, the Wayback Machine is this archive. I guess it's related to the Library of Congress, or in some ways American, right? And they archive websites on a regular basis throughout the interwebs. So when I built this website in 2009, you can go in the Wayback Machine and .org, I guess, the waybackmachine.org, and you can type in jazzguitarlessons.net and see what it looked like in 2009. So if you want to take a peek, that feel free. And then you can see it evolved over the years, the design and the content and whatnot. So to answer your question, what it looked like a very basic non-mobile website. Remember, not a lot of people carried iPhones in their pockets in 2009. Mm-hmm. And the website was ugly, but it was of its era. And SBI not only was a host, but it also was a system for training you to produce content that was relevant. So what they had me do at first, was build a blueprint of 50 pages, and go, well, what are the topics people are searching for? Use the Google keyword tool, you know, from AdWords, and determine what your tier, one is your homepage, and then your second tier should be these most powerful search terms, and then develop a handful, like 30 or 40 tier three pages. So that was my first thing, and I really bust my balls in the first 6 months to produce that content, which was mostly written. Remember that time Google had not even got a hold of YouTube yet. Mm-hmm. So it was a totally different era. So that was the first step. Yeah. 50 pages and a blueprint.
And was your goal at the time just to educate people, or were you selling anything at that point?
I was selling nothing. Actually, I just wanted to build the traffic, because the SBI promise was, well, once you have the traffic, you can ask them what they want and monetize that traffic. Mm-hmm. So I was making no money. And I guess SBI was probably $300 a year or something like that, which was scary for a poor jazz musician. But in the end, they gave me an SEO plan, you know, to put it in 2019 terms. That, mm-hmm. that was an SEO plan that they gave me to develop my content.
Well, it's interesting hearing you talk about mm-hmm. it, because that strategy of build traffic, build an audience first, then ask them what they want and create it is still honestly very good advice. Because with your first attempt, you said, you know, only two people purchased. Yeah. If you had, you know, taken the second approach, which you never could have known when you first got started, then you would have at least known, okay, I might have some people ready to buy this once it's created, give you a little more confidence that putting your time in would be worthwhile.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
Well, I just want to say that's how, you know, I read Tim Ferriss and whatnot, but that's how they say the best sellers are written. It's like you get this guy, I don't know if you're familiar with Mark Manson, mm-hmm. Tim Ferriss, and these guys, they write a blog and they just use analytics to tell them what they should read their book about. As opposed to the old, you know, 60s or 70s approach to being an author, get a book deal, lock yourself in a room for a year and write the best book you can ever write, and then publish it and expect it to be a bestseller. It's like, it doesn't work like that. So same with my website, and same with any other people that are getting online now, or started to get online the past 5 years-ish. It's like you don't have a crystal ball. You cannot know who's going to show up to your website. You're going to not know what they are willing to purchase or learn. In my case, it was learning. But yeah, very good point. It's the approach, I think. Mm-hmm. That's the best.
Even today, and even if you don't consider yourself to be highly data-driven, like you're saying, these guys, what they were probably doing is just seeing which blog posts or which pages got the most traffic. And that's mm-hmm. pretty easy to find. There are tools like Google Analytics. You can get that knowledge for free about your own site. So it's really amazing how today there's so much you can do to let people tell you what they want instead of guessing.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe I should have added that to my bio, but something I didn't tell you is I'm also a statistician by training and an actuary.
Oh my gosh, what don't you do?
Yeah, that's what people ask typically when they first meet me, like, who are you? I'm just a curious guy. I'm just interested in many things. And I would say I'm culprit of not using my analytics to the full depth of my knowledge with statistics. But I still do, and I still did make pretty good use of not only Google Analytics, but also other tools that help me, you know, how many comments or how many shares this post had and what people were commenting on within lectures of products actually that we sold. So I even have this program where we, no shame, like we cold email people that clicked on promotional emails but that did not purchase. And we go, hey, why didn't you buy? And we just collect this data, and those insights allow us to build better products, build better, you know, follow-up programs, or I don't know, change some of the videos that we sell, et cetera. But I think I'm getting ahead of myself. You probably had a few more questions before we dig in that part.
That's okay. Now you've got people excited to learn more about mm-hmm. what are these lectures, what are these courses he's talking about. Mm-hmm. So let's give the people what they want. So you started your website, it started to grow, traffic started to pick up. Was there a pivotal moment when you did start to sell something through your website, or what happened next?
Yes, I will give you only two pivotal moments because there have been several, you know, bangs and booms of traffic. The first one was about a year later after starting the website. So winter of 2010, I started to teach lessons on Skype. So I would just put a page and go, hey guys, if you like these resources I'm publishing and these new videos I put on YouTube, you know, there was a time limit of like 5 minutes on YouTube at that time before your account got unlocked. So I just put a page up and I said, it was pretty cheap. It was like $35 Canadian per Skype lesson for an hour. And I got people, especially from Australia and from the UK, to come in, some American people as well, because of the exchange rate. It was so advantageous for them to get a teacher that was cheap, or we say affordable. And for me, it was still a good rate I was charging. So that was a first really big moment of like, oh, wow, I can have like, I don't know, 10, 12, 15 students and do my teaching from my home instead of, you know, getting the car and getting to that music school or taking the bus at that time, which, yeah, of course, I didn't have a car. That was a really pivotal moment. The second pivotal moment was when I found out about this platform called Sparkio. And they're closed. They closed their shop in like 2012. And Sparkio just said, well, you know, it's like YouTube, but you can charge people money for that thing. So mm-hmm. I shot a course that was maybe a 15-minute course, which was actually follow on the screen, voice only. I'm going to show you how to learn the fretboard of the guitar and memorize every note without, you know, running through puzzles and problems. And I called it Learn the Fretboard. And instead of putting it on YouTube, and that must have been 2011 probably, I put it on YouTube and I didn't. I went, no, let me monetize this. So I probably charged, I don't know, probably $8 for it. And I sent an email, promotional email to my mailing list, where people would opt in just to get the newsletter and whatnot. I was producing a lot of new content. And one night I said, let me put this for 8 a.m. tomorrow morning. And maybe I sent to, I don't know, maybe 2,000 people. It was a small list. And when I wake up the next morning, I sold maybe for $8 worth, I don't know, maybe I sold $300-$500 worth of that $8 product.
Wow.
So I literally started to jump like 3 feet high in the air. My cat was looking, was like, dude, what's wrong with you? And I was so happy because it was, I would say in my life, it was the moment of confirmation. It's like, okay, if you're you and you do what you do and publish stuff, and part of it, you gate it behind a payment, people are willing to pay for it. So, you know, get off the couch and start doing that. So that was a really huge moment. Even though it was a small thing, it meant a lot. And the third one, and just for bonus, I was on the verge of becoming a professional statistician. So, you know, working for the government here and, you know, getting full-time job and getting settled. And I met a guy in California. I went to NAMM, which is that conference show, like this trade show for musical instruments, guitars, drums, lighting, sound effects, and whatever. So it was probably 2014 at that point. And I was in Anaheim. It's called NAMM, National Association of Music Merchants. And that guy said, do you have a website? I'm like, yeah. What's your mailing list? Like, I don't know, 10,000. His jaw dropped. It's like, how often are you emailing these guys about your products? I'm like, I don't know, maybe twice a year. So it's like, dude, you should send emails to people. I'm like, well, what if they unsubscribe? Well, I said, you should want some of them to unsubscribe to your mailing list and sell your friggin' products, dude. So that was the pivotal moment where I went, yep, I'm doing this full time now. And that was 2014. So I was like 5 years still being a musician and still, you know, being halfway. And then the past 5 years since 2014, it's been website full time. This is my work. So mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's really interesting that you were only emailing people twice a year and this guy's advice, mm-hmm. like you should want people to unsubscribe. That sounds counterintuitive, but it is actually great advice because if people are bothered by you sharing information about a product that is helpful, that could help people learn a new instrument or further their music knowledge, I mean, do you really want them on your email list at all?
There you go. Plus, if you never email them, they will forget who you are, even if they're interested. It's like, oh, who's that guy? All right. Mm-hmm. I'd forgotten about that. So it's not a good practice. And it was just fear. And I think it, to some extent, I still have it because to this day, we send 125,000 to 150,000 emails per month still. And I'm always a little bit scared because I'm like, well, what if people don't like it? And then I rationalize, oh, well, if people don't like it, they will unsubscribe, and then that's that. And you don't want them to unsubscribe because you want a bigger list to sell to, but a bigger list that's less interested is not better than a smaller list that you know the people are engaged. So that's still like, that's a lesson I'm still integrating to this day.
It's a very fine line, I think. A lot of us are asking the question, how much should I be emailing my list? How much is too much? How much is too little? And I'm curious to hear what you're doing in a second. But I think that there's no right answer. I think you know your own audience best, and you'll get a feel for what feels right for you personally as a creator. And then just put yourself in their shoes. If you're sharing really good knowledge, I'm sure it's not a bother for them to hear from you, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And my the main point with the software is now is you can have this manager subscription thing. So if you really like the newsletter, but you're tired of me trying to sell you on our main offer, just you can unsubscribe only from that promotional email. Or we have a series of, you know, best of, like those are the best posts. It goes out once a week and there's 52 posts, and it will loop back at the beginning once you're done. If you only like that series, you can elect to receive only that. And that's thanks to, you know, modern software.
Oh, that's a really interesting idea. So just in case people didn't catch that, part of your regular email marketing efforts are that you send one post a week, so 52 weeks worth of content, and then the following year, it loops through those same posts again?
Yes, and no shame admitting we're revamping, we're refreshing the content of that series because we're publishing new blog posts and videos and whatnot. So it was, at the time I started it, it was just the 50 most read pieces of content and video on the website. So it can be a hit or miss, but you know people are likely to remain engaged even just for that, because sending emails always asking, you know, buy this, buy that, do this for me. It's like you have to give something back. So I ensure that I have this newsletter that's regular, that has new stuff that's interesting to keep your open rates up. And you have this also the series of 52 best of, I call it what you might have missed from the blog. And at least twice a week, people see something that's really fresh, that's new. So your open rates are up. So they trust you. Whenever you want to sell something, you're still that guy that's friendly, that's been sending you great, you know, that's been sending you candy. And now he has a product to sell. So they're not as mad, I would say. That's a way to put it.
I think this is such great advice. And I hope people listening who are thinking about their own email marketing strategy are taking notes, because this point you're making about, you know, keep the best content. That's something that you know is popular, you know people will like. People are joining your email list all the time. So for most people, it'll feel fresh. And then also making sure that there is new content to make sure that people trust you and that they want to keep opening your emails. That'll make people think of you as a real authority, but also somebody who values their inbox, who's sharing great knowledge. And then when you sell them something, they'll either be excited to buy, or maybe the worst case scenario is they don't want to buy, but they respect the fact that you have something that is available if they wanted it later.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a whole mindset thing, and it's that perception of the engaged person is like, oh yeah, it's normal. That there's that $59 offer this week, and he's going to tell us twice about it with a countdown timer. It's like, people do that. And he's has all like 400 pages on the website of free stuff, so there has to be a way to put bread on the table. So absolutely, all agreed.
I think people expect you to have a product or a service or something to sell. And in some ways, I think it makes you look like even more of an authority because you do have a product or something that has a dollar amount that can be purchased. It makes you look like you know what you're talking about, that you've been able to package that into something, whether it's a course, a consulting offer, a freelance offer, really anything.
Agreed. Yeah, it makes you look good. And even if you don't, or for a certain period, you don't make these dollar offers, just maintaining your reputation through the free stuff is, that's the way I built my business personally. It's that's there's nowhere around it. It's like getting people in front of the free stuff. It's like almost treating it like you're selling the content of the newsletter, almost treating it like it matters more to you to get these people in front of your free content than in front of your products. Because if they like that, it's like, well, there's more where it came from. And naturally, just, you know, open your wallet and you'll get in. So,
really smart. So let's talk a little bit about your marketing, because we'll get back to the online courses and what it looks like today in a second. How do you find new people? I think that's such a struggle for a lot of creators. You said you were growing traffic pretty early on. So I'm curious, just throughout your time having this website, how do you get new people?
So since 2014, we realized, and that was through my coach, which I still talk to. I still talked this morning, actually. Was in a way, he was my best man at my wedding. He's not local, but we're really close. Oh. And in 2014, that guy, which will remain nameless, started to give me free unsolicited business advice on the website. I'm like, what do you know about it? What are you doing? And I found out he's a successful business guy with several businesses, with a family of four kids and this and that. And he has a coaching practice. So we still barter. So guitar lessons for coaching. And he just told me in 2014, it's like, yeah, you have all this stuff that you send people through email and YouTube videos and these sheet music upgrade, like these downloads of PDFs that goes with the lesson. Why don't you gate them behind a portal of some sort or an email address or whatever? And of course, my first answer was like, totally, no, it's never going to work, you know, resistance. And then I realized like, oh, shoot, this is the way to grow the mailing list, if you want, because people are not necessarily offended going like, hey, this is the sheet music that goes with that lesson. You watch me on YouTube. Here's the blog post. Here's the sheet music. It is free, but just give me your email. But it's still free, but give me your email. And that was almost like night and day once we started to do that for every piece of content. And now that's how we still collect leads to this day. I'm not really satisfied with that number yet, but we have approximately 1,300 organic leads per month. It's not a lot when you compare to the amount of traffic we have, but just that number is mostly coming from these small content upgrades. You have a tune, you have whatever, or you have this ebook that I wrote that is free. And we just capitalize on the fact that we do not need to pay for ads. We don't need to harass people. If they come and if they use the resources, we know they're qualified. We know they raise their hands and say, yes, you know, I want you to have my email. So that's how we do it. Yeah. Organically, in one word.
Mm-hmm. It's clever too, because when they come to your site, they do get some knowledge for free. But then this one little step further, just give an email address in exchange for this download. It's not a huge ask, but it's something small, both for them to, you know, earn the PDF, but also, like you said, to show intent, to show that this is somebody raising their hand who is qualifying themselves as a good, strong lead for you.
Exactly. Yep.
So once they do opt in to your list, of course, now you're continuing to grow that email list over time. Let's talk about what products you're offering today. So what does your suite of revenue generating stuff look like these days?
So the whole automation, the funnel, quote unquote, we could call it, is simply offering the membership, our subscription option, which was developed over the years. We developed a lot of curriculum-based video courses, and I got really tired of reinventing myself every month to go, what type of package can we offer? What type of promotional thing or discount can we run on people buying this? And then, you know, they buy it, and the next month you're like, do you want to buy again? Like, no, because I bought this last month and I didn't even finish your course. So we solved that problem now with the main offer, you know, keeping the main thing the main thing. It's subscribe, you will get everything. And of course, we have onboarding and we have programs just for the people that get the membership, which people, we can still buy a la carte, like one-time purchase as you go, of course. However, when you do that, you don't get the VIP treatment. You don't get access to the members-only stuff. So that's the main offer. People get offered within, I guess, the first 10 days of getting their email. They will get that offer in. If they do not, we just make a secondary a la carte offer, which I called First Steps, which is, in any case, it's a first course anyone should take when they go through the jazzguitarlessons.net curriculum. And we make it, I guess the offer now is $79. That's just a la carte, one product purchase. And then if they don't, we wait a week and we discount to, I guess it's 40% off, something like $47. Mm-hmm. So it's like, Membership. Nah, maybe you're not interested. Hail Mary, you want this instead. And then, if not, or if they do, or if they don't, no, I guess if they don't get a membership, then we send weekly promotional things. So every other week is a membership again through a different spin. It might be a discount. It might be first month at $1, or it can be a certain amount of discount off your membership. That's every other week. And the other week, we make a promotional offer of an a la carte thing. The a la carte thing being the goal of, you know, getting people to make that small step, that small commitment with a course, a single course, and then like it and love it and go, oh yeah, I'm going to get the membership now. So I guess that's the plan. Maybe I should patent this plan.
Clever strategy, because mm-hmm. it's something that we have done here at Teachable. A lot of businesses do. It's almost like a downsell strategy is a term that some people use, where you make your main offer first, but then you acknowledge some people aren't going to want that. Maybe the sticker price looks too large. Maybe it's not what they're looking for. But for whatever reason, they might still be a little bit interested. So if you mm-hmm. offer them something after that's a little bit smaller, a little bit less expensive, then you might still capture more people who could become customers. So it's a really smart strategy.
Yeah, I noticed you guys did that. And HubSpot does that as well. And sometimes when people are not ready to take your main offer, it might be timing. It might be that it was not framed in a way that clicked with that person, and that person where they are in their life right now or whatever. Maybe they were on vacation, you know, I don't know. But what I noticed, and that's a trick from a blog I read, I forgot his name, but really smart. A guy who worked for Mint, he was one of the first employees at Facebook. His name will come back. But Green, his blog is super green, but he has a lot of good business advice, and said they started to sell this course for becoming an online guy that makes more than $1,000 a month. That was the theme. And they just said, you can keep people in your mailing list and suggest that membership, that subscription for 8 months before some of them will say yes. And it's always the same offer. It's just, it's the verbiage, the words are a tiny bit different. And then you interview them. So why didn't you buy now? You bought now, but you didn't buy 6 months ago. And he explored that. If his name comes back, I will...
Are you talking about the founder of Mint?
One of the co-founders. I think he was...
I know the founder is named Aaron Patzer, but...
No.
It'll come to...
Sorry.
Well, people can go on their own personal adventure. Mint is a fascinating company. I'm sure that mm-hmm. it's worth looking into as well, as a quick kind of maybe Easter egg in this episode. It's a great way to track your own personal finances. So we won't get too into that. But
no.
This whole conversation, I think, is hopefully new for some listeners who haven't considered that there are different ways that you can sell, both in the strategy that we talked about, you know, start with the higher price, go to the lower price, but also just like what you were saying briefly 1 minute ago about what will speak to one person might not speak to everyone in the same way. The way that you make an offer, even if you're offering exactly the same thing, the way that you talk about it, even the time in their life that this comes up for them, it's totally varied. And so you've mentioned before, you kind of have to keep mentioning the offer. You can't just sell it once and then assume that if they didn't want it the first time, they would never want it again. And I think that's a common misconception.
Absolutely. For me, the interesting part as well, you said you offer a higher price and then you downgrade mm-hmm. or you make a downsell. But for me, the price is X a month. It might be $29 or $39. And then when I make that downsell offer, the dollar amount is actually higher, but the commitment is lower.
Mm-hmm.
It's mm-hmm. you pay once. It's like you're not a member. You don't need to check your credit card and cancel. I'm not going to try and fraud you. You know. So coming back, by the way, the guy also founded Sumo.
Are you talking about Noah Kagan?
Noah Kagan. That guy.
Oh, great. Yeah. Ding, ding, point for me.
So he founded AppSumo, which I bought several products, mm-hmm. and that's how I got into creating courses, actually.
Oh, great. He has a lot of really good online resources, too.
Yeah, and I got on Skype with Noah like two or three times, and he was collecting data on his past customers, and of course, I was able to get some advice. Amazing guy, and that's his build a $1,000 a month business course that they don't offer anymore, but he shared... That's one of his blog posts on his personal blog, where he shared that keep offering to the people, just what we were saying. It's one of the 38 lessons he's got in that that PDF you can download.
Yeah, he has a ton of great resources on,
yeah,
I think, what is his website? OKDork.com. If you search
for, OKDork.
If you search for Noah Kagan, a lot will come up.
He's got a great podcast as well, by the way.
Mm-hmm. And it's, well, I think what's interesting about his career and business is that it's evolved quite a bit over time. Like, I've had the pleasure of meeting him as well. And what he was doing 5 years ago is not necessarily exactly what he's doing today. So I think he's very opportunistic and he's really adapting. So that's why I always find his advice to be very helpful. I will say he's a very bold personality. He's not afraid of offending some people. And I think that's one of the things that his followers really like about him is that he's very unapologetic about who he is. Mm-hmm. But great advice. So that's a great resource.
Great. Plus, for, you know, AppSumo, the way it started when they found that niche, which is something that also happened to me. They found it, they raced it, and then it's like, okay, now that, you know, times have changed and let's make it as good as possible and keep it running. Same with sumo.com, which used to be Sumo Me or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's like that little share button on the left of the website. No shame, I'm still using it, but it looks a little bit 2012. And that's also, you know, it changes so much that he knows he can't rely on businesses online to be static like the old models of, you know, you build a business and you can keep, I don't know, building chimneys or homes or cars the same old way for the next 20 years. Like it doesn't work anymore. It's a blessing and a curse, I think.
Yeah, agreed. It's interesting because online business in particular evolves so quickly. And I think if you are a lifelong learner and you're willing to keep up and just try new things in your own business, that'll always put you so far ahead of the pack because I think a lot of people are not as willing to embrace new opportunities. So for anybody listening, even if you haven't started anything yet, just because somebody's been doing something for a long time doesn't mean they'll continue to always be successful. There's always room for new people to try things in new ways. So I wouldn't let what other people are doing, you know, deter you from starting, and just don't be afraid to experiment a little bit.
Agreed.
My last thought on the downsell, just because you mentioned that your membership actually costs less money, is that you make a great point. We don't want buyers to think that they should always be waiting for something to be cheaper and better next. I think most creators in Teachable, we always give our very best offer first. Your membership is the very best thing that you have. And hopefully that's something that people are excited about. And then the downsell is really geared toward a different audience. Like you said, somebody who's maybe not ready to go all the way in. They just want to dip a toe in the water. It's more of a starting point, I think, than a cheaper offering.
Yeah, I agree. It's like you want to get a taste, you know, low commitment, get a taste. It's a bit discounted. And this is, I'm a tester. Like I'm a real lifeline. I'm going to go ahead and try these things. And for years, I would have the total opposite approach, like discount to death. And you had these people, you built this following of people waiting for the next deal and literally only buying when it's a deal and never buying again, or maybe next year for that next $10 thing because I haven't finished taking this course, which is also the advantage of having a higher price point is, well, people get engaged and they do the homeworks and they get in touch and they get involved in the actual membership side, like being a full member and being part of a community. So yes. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that actually. The concept that the different price point or even having a membership versus a one-off changes the quality of students that you attract, I think is really important. Yes. Like if you have this really excellent course, you've put a ton of your time and effort into it, and you only charge $20 for it, there's also the perception that the course comes off as cheap if people don't know you. So I think a lot of people are afraid to price at a higher price point, but not only do you earn the money that you're worth, but you're also attracting the right kind of students who are willing to put in the work, who value your expertise. It makes you look more professional.
Agreed.
And then now you've done a membership program. So how has your business shifted since you moved into that membership model?
Oh, yeah. Now we have subscription revenues are close. I think this month is 79 or 80%. Wow. I'm really close to my numbers, by the way. So 80% of the gross and the remainder, the rest is like private lessons here and there. These a la carte, like one-time purchase that are used as promotion, like that first step thing or whatever is on sale now. And that's evolved from 2016. And I have a few thoughts about this because in 2016, I went, all right, I have so much. Let me just all bundle it, use the Teachable function, bundle, and make this a monthly price. And my first thought is, when I used to price this $19, and it was less stuff in it as well, but $19 a month, I would discount it to 15 or 12 or 9 even. And I would hear that it was too expensive. It was too much of a commitment. Now that it's up at 39 and 29, never have I heard so much of the people say it's a steal. Mm. That's a great deal. And it's twice the price or more, right? And that perception you were talking about, that was a really hard lesson to learn. And I've also increased the price of the a la carte courses. People can still get them. They used to be anywhere between 39, 44, or $49, so 40 or 50. They all jumped simultaneously at the same time to 129. So it allowed me to have this higher value for all the stuff we bundled together. Now you have $4,500 worth of stuff waiting for you. And now comes my second point. My second lesson about this was, in the beginning, I used to sell that membership a lot on the amount of content. You get all this. Like, you know, get Netflix. You're going to watch all your favorite TV shows and series and then, I don't know, House of Cards and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I realized that we are, number one, we're not Netflix, so we don't have that same amount, because I'm the only course author, if you want. There are no other authors. There's one or two, but it's not as significant. Like, the catalog is 99% me. And so number one, it's like, okay, we're not Netflix. We don't have that much stuff. And secondly, people learning music, especially learning jazz, because it is, quote unquote, complicated, they're not looking for more stuff. They're already coming in. They're already overwhelmed. And they just want someone to take them by the hand and lead them through the content, because they've bought books that collected dust, that still collect dust today. They've taken courses, private lessons, this and that. And if they wind up on my website, they're not looking for more, they're looking for less. So as soon as I got that, I just took all the courses that we had built and I lined them up, and I called this the learning path, A to Z, one course after another. And then I sold the membership as, come learn from our A to Z approach and don't be overwhelmed. I'll tell you every step of the way what your next step is, whatever. So that's been the biggest insight into selling a membership. You're not selling on amount. You're selling on the benefits of what it is, actually.
Mm, that's really strong advice. I think the way that you just phrased that too, people don't want a ton of knowledge. They don't want an overwhelm of information or another book to collect dust. They want the benefits. They want the outcome. They want to be led. That's all so true. And I think packaging it in a way that says, I'll take you there one step at a time. I mean, that resonates with me in a way that, here's all my knowledge, sift through it yourself, you know?
Good luck.
Good luck, exactly. I think that's such a powerful approach. So it can only probably happen for listeners who are at a point where they have a lot of content, but just the thought, how can I order this in a way that would create a path for somebody to follow, is a really great idea.
Mm-hmm. And I have to admit, it has been an evolving idea with the learning path, because I went, some jazz guys are more looking to learn chords, you know, chords like accompaniment. You're going to accompany someone else, you know, chord strumming guitar. Like, okay. And some other people want to play, you know, lead guitar. They want a solo. So actually, and et cetera. So back then, when I started the learning path, I created three learning paths. And I was just creating more confusion. And eventually I created one learning path, and that's a really deep secret for people that have a lot of content and are wondering how to better sell and stop, you know, fooling around with these discounted promotions on certain parts of content or bundles. Or I'm going to share what I've done. I call this a concierge program. And that concierge is simply a way to create a course of courses. So we have, I don't know, 18 or 20 courses, and I created a curriculum of concierge that is saying, okay, let's look at that first video course you should take now for jazz guitar, and let me split it in 6 weeks for you. and here's your workout, your practice regimen, almost like your gym workout your coach would give you. And this week, that's all you have to do. And if you do this every week, you're going to master the entire curriculum. And each section of a lecture section in the Teachable platform is actually one course that's split over 6 to 8 weeks. And each week has a video of me going through, you know, the assignment and a PDF that they print out. It's like, oh, this is my program. So you could go through the curriculum, the courses themselves, and just say, okay, that's next. But my concierge program has just helped people know more of where they're at, because when they go complete each lecture, that progress bar is the progress bar of all the courses they're taking in the curriculum. Mm, and we figured it out. It's about 2 years worth of learning if someone is serious, wow. Like two and a half years. Yeah,
I mean, it does take time to really learn an instrument, so it makes sense.
Yeah.
It's almost like reminding me of the difference between buying a gym membership, which may have different classes and options, or you could go yourself, and then investing in a personal trainer who will really guide you.
Yeah, it's like the fine line between actually taking a private lesson and or just getting a membership. But when people say, can I take private lessons with me? I'm like, man, sure, I can repeat whatever I put in the videos for you. We'll do it on Skype, but I'm going to tell you all the same stuff. Like, I don't have more stuff that I hide from my private people. It's
like, this is it.
So, yeah, this is it, literally.
I'm curious, before I know we have to wrap shortly, has anything mm-hmm. been unexpected or surprising for you about running an online business?
Absolutely. The first thing was that selling on the amount that we just talked about, order, like saying, this is a learning pad, this is A to Z, take me by the hand type of thing. That was a big surprise. The other big surprise was, I found this through the first 5 years. I would say the first 5 years were prep, and then the second 5 years were, you know, business. I expected to build a website for peers, for people that went to college in jazz or wanted to go, you know, kids, you know, 18-year-olds, wanted to audition for Berklee College or whatnot. And it did not happen that way at all. I built these resources to realize that that's a surprise. The target audience is actually 45 to 65 male. There are these guys that are older gentlemen, and the kids have gone to college, and that guitar has been sitting in the case or in the corner, and somehow their dad used to listen to Miles Davis and Frank Sinatra. Mm. So I sort of pivoted and went, that's where my crowd is, not over here. These guys are interested in the way I explain stuff. The kids that are going to college, they don't need me. You know, they're going to college. So that was a big, big, big revelation.
It's smart, though. You were listening to who was coming to your site, and you said you adapted, you pivoted. A lot of people mm-hmm. could have just, you know, dug in their heels and said, no, I want to target this person I thought it was. But mm-hmm. it's very business savvy to pay attention to what's going on and to really kind of go with it.
Yeah. And make things simpler. And even when it is simple, make it like 10 times more simple. You know, you want to explain something on a video, whatever. I sat down. Okay. In jazz, we use this word called comping. And comping is a short for accompaniment. Comping. So we say, see, it's like camping with an O, comping. So I sat down and I wrote the curriculum to that comping course. And actually what happened is that which I wrote, I still have the paper lying around somewhere, which I wrote, it became three courses. It became comping 101, 102, and 103. That's how I called my courses, just for to be funny. And if I had been me from 10 years, I would have crammed this into one course. And people would have been, you know, not learning anything from it. So that's also a bit of advice for creators. Just make it step by step. Don't assume that people have mastered the previous steps. Just drill it down again and again and again.
I'm sure, too, it must be rewarding for somebody to finish the 101 level. But if you had put mm-hmm. all of that together, it would take them forever to get to the end, and possibly they could give up in the middle. But if you can give people the sense of accomplishment of completing one level, I feel like that must give them a little bit of a boost to move on to the next one.
Yeah, small wins. The small wins are that's what the community is about as well. You know, we have these challenges on Facebook. We have these shout outs like, hey, you know, Bob has been doing great these days. And often it's the guys that need these encouragements, that they need the support that we provided to. We have polls. We're like, okay, what type of guitars or amplifiers are playing through? Or, you know, and we keep the people engaged to see that it's doable after all. Yeah, that's a small win.
Mm-hmm. What you just said, encouraging people and showing them that it's doable after all. I think that's so important. Just showing that it's possible, seeing other people in the community who have accomplished things. I'm sure that must feel to any of your students like, oh, if they can do it, so can I.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And there's stories of people of all level, because, you know, music is, it's difficult to like have 2 or 3 or 10 musicians to be exactly the same level. Mm-hmm. There's always that guy that's more advanced in this or that, or that has a bit of a weakness in another area. And just seeing a beginner do something might be so motivating for an advanced player, or vice versa. Maybe an advanced player will show something or have trouble with something in one of the things he posts on our Facebook group. And then the beginner will be really motivated. It's like, oh, well, I thought that Bob was a professional, but now I see him and I see his weakness. So it means there's hope for me, you know, type of thing. That's been at the heart of our approach.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Well, before we go, what's next for you in your business?
Well, one of the things I told the team, actually, I work with Filipino virtual assistants and I work with local managers. I wanted to take a moment to thank them, because I told them as a joke in our meeting yesterday, it's like, I'm going to ensure I give you guys as least credit as possible for all of this. So I could not have made it without that team, and it's growing. I did lose a few really good employees this year, and I've trained new ones. So people that are on board, thank you. And I'm trying to make the business as good an environment for the people that, you know, buy the products and take the courses, but also for the people that work in it, because the people that work with me were musicians. So we know that, you know, life and work and music and families, like, we all have to balance it out. So I wanted to thank them. And what's next is, I'm actually I would say serial entrepreneur. So I have other businesses, and that's an advice I would have for creators. I would not have expected that the skills I developed, that are non-musical skills actually, would be of use later in business. So I'm helping other businesses with their CRMs, and I'm doing consultancy, in fact. And I have this partnership in which we are building, so we're almost like buying into business, you know, on the equity side, and we're like doing a turnaround or flipping businesses. And this is totally, it's a really strange world that I was not accustomed to outside of my actuarial studies. And in the end, it's all the skills of troubleshooting and managing a team and building curriculums and making promotional emails and all these skills, these tools that, you know, maybe one of our grandpas or grandmas would say, that's not a real job. It's like, no, this is a realist job. This is where I built all my skills and where it's taking me to other business ventures that are totally not musical. So that's what's next. Is, I'm a business guy, and I didn't even expect I would be one, but I became one through music, which is sort of strange. And I met my wife, and she's the same. She has a music school, and she's really entrepreneurial in whatever she does. But yet, she's a musician as well. So that's what's next for us, I think.
Mm-hmm. It's exciting to hear how both of you have had this passion for music and then turned that into online business opportunities, and now have grown that skill set of, you know, online business into even more opportunities. So it's very exciting, mm-hmm. And you know, I'm very hopeful for all of your new ventures. And
thank you.
Before we go, just any last words of wisdom or inspiration for our listeners?
Yeah. Don't trying to say something hashtag deep, but I don't think it's going to happen. I would say, don't be afraid. Just go for it, and let the environment tell you what to do next, because you can't figure it out. We have small brains. You know, there's so much happening. We have so little control over what's happening, but typically when it comes time to do or say something, you will know. So follow that.
I think that was pretty hashtag deep.
There you go.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining the podcast. It's been such a pleasure getting to know more about you and your business.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
Thank you so much for joining us this week. You can learn more about Mark, jazzguitarlessons.net,
and Teachable in the show notes at teachable.com/EIT10. Before you go, make sure you subscribe to the podcast so you can receive new episodes right when they're released. And if you're enjoying the podcast, we hope you'll leave us a 5-star review. On behalf of Team Teachable, we hope you enjoyed this episode about jazz guitar with Marc-André Séguin. We'll see you in the next episode of Everything is Teachable.
This podcast is produced by Teachable, where our mission is to empower creators to transform their knowledge into income. To date, we've helped over 60,000 creators build and sell online courses that have been shared with almost 20 million students, and we're just getting started. To learn more or start creating for free, visit teachable.com.